Auf dem Weg steht der Boy, steht er eingebogen. Alle Figuren in dem Boy sehen sie zu.
I connected my life to the Jewish cemetery in Zduńska Wola. I feel that I need to do that and that it's very important for people, also for me, because nobody take care of this place and nobody used to take care of Jewish memory of my town. And I think that, you know, if this is a part of history of my town, so this is also part of me.
Hello, welcome to Polish Pilgrimage on the Spirit of Things on RN. I'm Rachel Kahn. On November 9th and 10th, 1938, 30,000 Jewish men were arrested in Nazi Germany and Austria and sent to concentration camps. Synagogues were burned, businesses vandalized. Kristallnacht signaled the beginning of the Holocaust. In Poland alone, the home of 3.3 million Jews, 3 million would perish. Today, a new Australian film, Pockets of Hope, shows another side of Poland that has grown up after the Second World War and the Holocaust.
Hi, I'm Judy Menzel, and I'm a filmmaker, and I've just made a film called Pockets of Hope, which is set mainly in Poland.
I'm Faye Sussman. I'm a Yiddish klezmer singer. I was born in Poland, and I guess you could say, or I feel, that I'm a social activist as well. And putting the two together is the reason why I went to Poland.
And you made this film. Welcome, Judy and Faye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Pockets of Hope is a very resonant title. Obviously, something that is counter to how many Jews today view Poland.
Well, that was one of the main hurdles that we had in getting financing and actually going to Poland, with the attitudes, starting with my own family, my mother being an Auschwitz survivor, just couldn't, we weren't speaking by the time we came to filming, because she and most Holocaust survivors, whether they were in a concentration camp or in any form of the Shoah, have such a hatred for Poland. And even though, you know, things were not necessarily Polish in nature, there was Germans and Nazis, but because it happened on Polish soil, there is this fear and loathing for Poland.
And Faye, how about you? Did you want to go back?
No. I was born in Poland in 1946, a year after the Holocaust. So you can imagine Poland was a massive graveyard then. My parents, my father, I guess he spoke about his experiences, which were really terrible. And I was heartbroken, but I only knew his side of the story. Not until many, many years later did I discover that there were actually Poles who saved Jews. For my father growing up, I heard that he was daubed on. And my husband's family, who were Polish, when I came back from Siberia, they were interned in labor camps. So when they came back to their little town looking for relatives, surviving relatives and their home, they found that their home has been taken by Poles and their lives were threatened. So we grew up with those stories. So, of course, I vowed that I would never set foot in that country. I would never say I was Polish. I lived in Israel for 10 years. From the age of 4 until the age of 14, I lived in Israel. So if people asked me, where were you born? I would say I'm from Israel. And it's a miracle what's going on in Poland now. And
well, indeed, Pockets of Hope really does reveal and show people who have a very different attitude toward Jews than what prevailed during the Holocaust. And one of those people is Kamila Klauzinska, an extraordinary young woman who is in the town of Zduńska Wola. Judy, how did you find out about her?
Well, through a friend of mine bringing her cousin to one of Faye's concerts. We started to talk, and Faye was introduced to Jan through my friend Estelle, and he started to talk about these young people, and he'd met her in Zduńska Wola, where his family were from, and we're just so knocked out. It inspired us, Faye particularly, to want to do something to thank her and the many, many young Poles like her for what they're doing, which is reviving Jewish memory in their small towns, in their, we call them shtetls, which were towns which were, the majority of the population were Jewish before the Shoah. And it was just incredible.
And in her case, she was actually taking care of the Jewish cemetery, which she played in as a child and seemed not to know what she was playing in. It was kind of a magical place for them.
That is actually in homage to her. We open the film with her in the cemetery discussing how, as a young child, she found it as a magical garden, a magical place with all these mysterious writings carved into stone, with no idea who had been there or why they were there. And here she is, so many years later, you know, going on to study Jewish studies at Jagiellonian University and actually receiving a PhD for the work she did in tracing relatives and clearing the Jewish cemetery in Zduńska Wola.
Well, here she is in the film explaining what motivates her.
People ask me the question, why you are going there? Why you take care of this place? Are you Jewish? You have to be Jewish because no one normal person could go and clean the Jewish cemetery. Why you are doing it? So I couldn't understand because I'm Zduńska Wola, you know, so this is part of my town. So I'm sorry. We need to take care of the cemetery and especially the memory.
Well, Faye, you are a singer of Yiddish klezmer songs, and you ended up going to Poland giving concerts. But what changed your mind here in Australia to actually consider that as an option?
When I heard about this young, beautiful young woman and these young people, straight away, I thought to myself, these are the heroes of today. They are the living righteous of today. Why do we have to wait until we are dead to honor people? I'm a Polish born who grew up feeling terrible pain about what my family went through. And here I'm hearing about these young people and what they're doing. They have restored my faith in humanity. I wanted to thank them. So I said to Jan, I said, I wouldn't want to sing in some commercial festival. It doesn't really have that much meaning to me. But I would go and sing in Kamilastown. And I would sing for free because I don't want money to be a subject of the reason why I'm going. It has to be about acknowledging their goodwill, about their pain, past pain, and why they're doing this. Maybe they could keep the money and keep doing this work. For my second generation, to break that message, that blame, and that stereotyping. And I do know that Elie Wiesel, in his book, and Sabina van der Linden Wolensky said in Berlin in her speech that the children are not responsible for the crimes of the elders, but they're held responsible for what they do with the memory. And here are these beautiful young people who have to pick up the pieces in a country that was a massive graveyard.
And in fact, you had already experienced something of the Poles who saved Jews when you were involved in Courage to Care,
yes,
which is the B'nai B'rith project that goes to schools.
That's
and
right.
Teaches against bullying. Tell me about what happened.
Well, I'm a guide, you know, through my concerts. A lovely woman called Eva Engel reached out to me and said, I love the way you tell stories and through song, and we're looking for guides. And she recruited me to Courage to Care, and I didn't really know what it was about. But when I realized it was an anti-bullying project that travels telling the stories of people who risked their lives to save Jews, and there were all kinds of people, like Christians and Muslims, and, you know, that our nation is alive today because of these people who had the courage to care. And it inspires young people. But in every town that we went to, we always looked for a local hero in Australia so we can also acknowledge the local hero, which is in comparison to the righteous of the past. So the children today can get a correlation between the two. And that inspired me because that's how I saw those young people in Poland. They are the living heroes, the righteous. And I need to thank them.
Judy, how did you go about making this film? It has so many people in it. It really focuses on this incredible, almost double side of Poland's history, the dark side in which most of the 3 million Jews in Poland lost their lives, and yet this positive side of people wishing to reclaim Jewish history, as it were, of their towns, of their local towns. What was the plan? How did you plan this film?
Well, I'd like to say that there was a grand master plan, but we really began on a journey of discovery. And that was when Faye and I went to the wonderful Polish consul here at the time, a young man called Daniel Groman, and we discussed what we wanted to do and talked to him about Camilla. And he said, I can't really help you with the film, but I can organize a study tour for Faye, for yourself, for me as a filmmaker. And we have a wonderful colleague who is the co-director who also did the photography and the sound, Paul Green. And he organized for the three of us to go to Poland and for 10 days meet people. And because Paul was with us, we had a chance to document that and interview people. And then we had to try and organize the musical side of it, because that was what we wanted to do, because we really felt that music and the music that Faye does, the klezmer music, is such a way into people, and that's often brought up in the film. It's a leveler. It opens a window into people's hearts. And so we organized between us a tour of these wonderful musicians with Faye, including Daniel Weltlinger, Emily Rose Sarkova, and John Maddox, to these three former towns. And when we were organizing that, there came the opportunity to do a concert at the Museum for the History of Polish Jews, which was incredible, standing ovations, lines of people, and it was quite stunning. So we came back with 100 hours of footage, and then the decisions had to be made. And it was very difficult because we could have just done, you know, a very positive spin, because Faye is a great performer and a wonderful storyteller, and she really evokes all those memories and images through her music of, you know, Isaac Bashevis Singer's world, you know, of shtetls and love affairs gone wrong and longing and searching. But I thought that the whole tour wouldn't have the depth if people didn't understand how difficult it was for someone who is second generation, whose family had been through so much, which is Faye's story and my story too. And so I wanted to put other voices in, and that's why we brought in Ostentatious, the wonderful Sandy Goodman, who acts as a sort of the Greek chorus, or I would say the Jewish chorus of my father remembers this, my father remembers that.
And here he is giving his estimation of Poland.
It's a graveyard. I'm not going there. I don't want to know. It's horrible. It's a graveyard of the Jewish people.
And that's what it is. It's a graveyard. And it's a place that Jewish culture thrived and is just a remnant right now. So it's a huge catastrophe. There's just no excuses, and there's no,
we didn't know, nobody knew.
There's none of that.
The serious side of Sandy Gutman, also known as the stand-up comic Ostentatious. Later in today's Spirit of Things, we'll hear about the new Museum of Polish Jewish History, which concentrates on the 1,000 years in which Polish Jews and Christians lived together in relative peace. You're with RN and online. You can find us on the RN homepage. Thank you. Nuggets of Hope premiered at the International Jewish Film Festival in Sydney this year, and it follows the tour of klezmer singer Faye Sussman and the people she meets who are making Poland a place Jews actually want to come back to, at least for a visit. Music, Faye, is kind of the thing, the glue that holds people together in this film to some extent, but especially klezmer music. What is it about this kind of music interwoven with Yiddish songs that touches people?
It's music that's performed in a minor chord. It is music that expresses all emotions in one song. I always thought of klezmer being somewhat like Chagall's paintings that talks about the travels and the experience of the Jewish people through time in history. And this is how I see klezmer. Because today, in the 21st century, klezmer is incorporated with Yiddish as a way of keeping the language alive as well. So not only as a klezmer singer, but really as a storyteller of my people's journey through time and history, through the song.
It's also the kind of music, as you say, it's got all the emotions. Just when you're feeling really down or sad, it's also very funny. I mean, you have a song about a pickpocket.
Yes, there's a song about a pickpocket. There's actually the papirosen.
The paper
cigarettes. It's the very first song I ever learned for my father.
When you were in a cafe, the Cheder Cafe, I think it was, you were speaking to Magda, a violist and also a singer.
Yes.
A Polish young woman. That was a very moving exchange between you. Tell me about her and how she came to sing these songs.
In the film, we talk a little bit about that, actually, because as a country, Poland was under communism, and during communism, you couldn't talk about anything Jewish or any culture. But since the fall of communism and the freedom of democracy in Poland, a lot of young people are free now to find out about history and are discovering a whole world that they didn't know existed before. A lot of them are feeling pain about it. All of a sudden, their memories, their psyche, is starting to connect with little memories from grandparents in the past. And are starting to question. We don't know why. So Magda had no idea that her family, that there was Jewish heritage. But in her childhood, she heard her grandmother humming this Yiddish melody, but never knew it was Yiddish. But now you've got the fall of communism, you've got the revival of Jewish culture, Jewish music and everything. And all of a sudden, it's starting to connect in her psyche, in her soul, which I think she expresses that led her to this desire to connect with Ashkenazi music, with Yiddish and klezmer. And it became one of her missions because she plays the viola. She sang in heavy metal bands. She sings in Macedonian. She sings in many languages. But when we were in Poland, we went to listen to her perform. It's called the klezmer hoys. It's in a Jewish quarter where they have the Krakow Festival every year. And she sings in this restaurant that they serve Jewish food. And I was totally, totally blown away. Not only is she beautiful in every possible way, her soul, her art, her inner, but the way she sings the Yiddish songs as if she is her voice for her grandmother. You could feel it in her soul. I had goosebumps all over.
When I record my first CD 10 years ago, I went to my grandmother and she was listening to these songs. And during the song Mein Yiddische Mame, she starts to cry. She starts to cry, and she was crying and crying and crying and crying and crying. And then she told us the story, with no one know in our family, that she is a Jewish. My grandmother, she died 4 years ago, but no one knew about it. Only my grandfather and she. And the story was that he helped her to escape from the transport to the death camp. He was a communist. He just stole her, and she changed everything. All her family died during the Shoah, and her name was not Jadwiga, but Chaya.
Es ist nicht besser in der Welt. Mein jüdische Mama, oh wei, wie bitter, wenn sie fällt. Wie schein ohne Licht ist ein Haus, wenn die Mama es tut. Wie traurig finster wird, wenn Gott nimmt mir, ob er neu abhört. Im Wasser, im Feuer, wo sie gelaufen, mein Kind. Nicht hatten ihr Tier, du siehst gewiss die Kräste sie.
Oh, wie glücklich und reich ist der Mensch, wo soll. Als er schöne Matune geschenkt von Gott, als er altige jüdische Mama. Mein jüdische Mama, I long to hold her more than now. Mein jüdische Mama, I long to kiss her wrinkled brow. I long to hold her once more, as in days gone by, and ask her to forgive me for all the things I did to make her cry.
Judy, it would surprise many listeners, I think, to this program that Krakow has an annual Jewish cultural festival that is huge, and probably 2015, it's in its 25th year. As a filmmaker, I imagine that it was a great gift for you, this culmination of a pilgrimage in a joyous celebration. Who started this festival?
It was started by a wonderful man called Janusz Markus. I mean, he's just a remarkable man. And really, he was one of the leaders in this whole revival of Jewish culture in Poland. And it started as a tiny little festival, you know, in one street in Krakow. And now it's just got thousands and thousands of people coming. The majority of the people that come to the festival are non-Jewish Poles. And I've got to say, as a Jewish person, to see people dancing and singing and so interested and thirsty for knowledge of all things Jewish, not just Polish Jewish, but Israeli Jewish, everything. And it was just beautiful, you know, and we capture that in the film with the music, and we see all the thousands dancing. And I think so many people will be shocked and moved to see something like that, and people just won't believe it. But, you know, it has been going for so many years, and he speaks so well, and he says, you know, I come from Poland, he said, you know, where people were burned in barns. And he said, but I also come from Poland, where people were saved and hidden in barns. And for me, I think that's one of the most powerful statements in the whole film. And I know that it moved me and still does every time I look at it.
Was Janusz Jewish?
No, he's not Jewish. He just happened to meet some Jewish people, and he just got inspired. And that's what took on the whole journey of the festival.
Well, some people have dismissed such festivals as an effort to assuage an unforgivable past, a way to make money at the expense of Jews who come. But your film addresses all these concerns.
Yes, it does. And it's been very hard, and it was very hard to sort of keep the dark and the light balanced in the film, and really tried for that. And I hope and I think that we have achieved that, because, as I say, and Faye says this in the film, it's very hard to look forward without looking back. And you really have to know what has been in order to move forward and change for the future, I think.
And one of the people in this film who is not actually alive any longer, but who is obviously a great and inspiring force to many Catholics, is John Paul II.
That was something that I was so surprised about. I mean, I'd always heard about it through my family, but to actually interview people and hear what an influence John Paul was on the Polish people, and the fact that he is the first pope in 2,000 years to come into a synagogue since the times of Jesus. I mean, I had forgotten that, and it's a huge deal. I mean, the fact that he really did change the Catholic Church, and as we say in the film, it's changed Poland. And I really think that that's just been another huge force in this interest, revival, longing for Jewish memory in their country and Jewish presence.
Yes, one of the young women you speak to talks about herself as a JP2 generation. And here is the rabbi of Poland, Michael Szudryk, who succinctly states the importance of John Paul II.
One could say that Pope John Paul II did more than any other human being in the last 2,000 years to effectively fight anti-Semitism. And John Paul changes the Catholic Church and changes Poland even more. The Catholic Church, before Vatican II, openly spoke about the guilt of the Jews. So the Catholic Church had a very definite relationship and attitude towards Jews for its almost first 2,000 years of existence. And then, miracle, it's a miracle. Vatican II takes the Jews from a negative to a neutral, and John Paul II takes the Jews from a neutral to a positive.
Well, Faye and Judy, a pilgrimage is a spiritual journey. And I wonder how it left you. What are the feelings and beliefs or convictions that you are left with, Faye?
In 2011, my husband decided he was going to take me to Poland for the first time since my birth, to the Krakow Festival. And it was scary for me. And we went to Auschwitz, and I met a lot of klezmorim and people and musicians. It was something very amazing. But waiting in the queue to go to the toilet in one of the Jewish centers in the middle of the Krakow, two young girls, very young girls, and I started having a chat. And I asked them where they are from and why they were here at this festival. They said that they wanted to learn more about Jewish culture. They were not Jewish girls. One was 19, one was 20. They wanted to know more about Jewish culture because in their home they have grown up with belongings to Jewish people, and they always felt haunted by it. And it led them with this feeling that they need to understand and more. And then they asked me about me, and I told them how that I was born in Poland in 1946 and told them the truth, that I was angry. And the two girls got upset. One girl started crying and started apologizing to me for what happened here in Poland. And the other girl got defensive and said it wasn't our fault. We were perpetrated on. And that left me, that was the first thing that left me with this feeling that these young people, this generation, are suffering. And they, my God, can you imagine? I thought to myself, having to live in this country with this history and try to live a normal life in the shadows of graveyards. And that stayed with me. And I remember telling Judy this. And then when Judy introduced me to Jan, and I heard about the other people, that was my reason for wanting to go to Poland. I actually received the invitations at registered mail at my door from those towns. asking me, from these young people, they sent me the invitations asking me to honor them by coming and singing.
Judy, is this film also, in a sense, about honoring the Poles?
In a sense, it is. My stepfather, who was with me longer than my own father, was from Lublin, Poland, and he had always talked about what a beautiful life he and his family had had and how terrible it was that everything was wiped out, and he was a sole survivor. And it had lived in me, and I'd seen the pain and the hatred, and as I said, of my mother as well, being a survivor of Auschwitz and the few members of our family that did survive. But what really was a strong motivation for this film was the anti-Semitism that's going on in Europe at the moment. Just feeling so helpless, and having a young daughter, my daughter's 20 years old, watching her and her friends, you know, even at university, suffering and hearing things. And it was this helplessness. And I saw that through music and through this tour, that it is a way to open people up, and it is a way to have some meeting point. And with European Jews really suffering again, and that possibly through music and through a shared culture, something can change.
And Judy, it sounds from the film, at any rate, that Poland is the exception in this wave of anti-Semitism in Europe, that indeed it seems that it's decreasing there.
I could not believe it. And if somebody had told me, and still when I speak to many Holocaust survivors, no one can believe that actually at the moment, Poland is probably the least anti-Semitic place in Europe. We were blown away by this. And it really will be, I think, a big surprise for people when they see the film, and to see this genuine interest and openness and willingness to learn and change and come together. And that was one of the wonderful things that Faye did, the fact that she went there with such an open heart, something that many second-generation people cannot do, and which many told me before we went. They just can't let go. And as I say, we're not forgetting, and we're not necessarily forgiving, but we're opening to something new, something where we can walk together and work on something. And maybe there's some chance for this shocking hatred that's rising up again.
Well, as Camilla says in the film, we need to talk to each other. And Judy and Faye, I'd like to thank you so much for this film, which is clearly opening a pocket of hope in Poland to the rest of the world.
This is a universal message. And the universal message, and how I see it, and so does Judy, and so does Paul Green, is that a message like that can inspire pockets of hope in grassroots. It can inspire between Palestinians and Israelis, between Russians and Ukrainians, Serbians and Bosnians, because it is about grassroots and the people. So we hope that when this goes around the world, it can start more pockets of hope to bring more hope to the world.
Auf dem Weg steht der Bull, steht er angebogen, alle Vögel in dem Bull.
The power of music to bring hope to the world. That's my guest, Faye Sussman, who has bigger hair than me, singing a Yiddish klezmer song from the album Klezmer Divas. And Judy Menzel with her film Pockets of Hope with co-director Paul Green, which premiered at this year's International Jewish Film Festival in Sydney. You're listening to The Spirit of Things on RN and online. If you've been to Poland, send us a tweet at Spirit of Things and tell us what's your favorite memory of Poland.
I'm the only Yiddish playwright in Europe today. Coming to Poland is finding my roots, because we are a Polish-Jewish family. My parents always spoke Yiddish and Polish, so this was travel, a travel in time for me.
to, co jest dla mnie najważniejsze w żydowskim
Apart from the annual Jewish festival in Krakow, another big attraction to Poland is the new Jewish Museum in Warsaw, which opened in 2013. To tell us about it is Barbara Kirschenblatt-Gimblett. Born in Toronto, she moved to New York and now lives in Poland. Barbara is a scholar of performance and Jewish studies and is a museum curator and consultant. The museum in Poland is the capstone of her many achievements.
It's Pauline Museum of the History of Polish Jews, and it stands in Warsaw facing the monument to the Warsaw Ghetto Heroes. And the word Pauline comes from a beautiful legend the Jews told themselves about how they came to Poland and why they stayed. And we use the rendition by Agnon, the Nobel Prize laureate for Hebrew literature. And the story goes something like this. Jews experienced persecution in Western Europe, and they came east, and they found themselves in a forest. And they heard the word Pauline, which they thought was Hebrew, Pauline, rest here, here you shall dwell. And the legend varies. Maybe the cloud broke, the angel's hand pointed, Pauline, or the birds chirped, Pauline, or the pages of the Gemara floated down, or there were words in Hebrew carved on the trees. And they said, here we should rest until we are taken to the land of Israel.
Well, like all legends, they have many versions and renditions. There's a beautiful screen in the front of the Pauline Museum where the Hebrew letters and Polish letters are intertwined. And that sort of signals something about the intermingling of Polish and Jewish life, which that legend, in a sense, illustrates.
Yes, indeed. We think of the thousand-year history of Polish Jews, which is what we present in our multimedia narrative exhibition, as a story of people who were categorically Jewish and distinctly Polish. And there's so many beautiful expressions of this symbiosis of people who live together, but also apart. It's a story of cooperation and competition, of coexistence and conflict, of separation and integration.
And yet that coexistence, as it were, ended in the Holocaust, where most of Polish Jews died. So there's a kind of irony at the basis of this.
Well, this is a story of a thousand years of continuous presence of Jews in Polish lands, which is not something one can say for Spain, England, France, Germany, Austria. The Holocaust was absolutely cataclysmic for the Jews of Europe and for the Jews of Poland. Before the war, there were 3,300,000 Jews in Poland, and 90% of them were murdered. And of those who returned, about 240,000 survivors were in Poland at the end of the war. Some returned from the Soviet Union. In fact, most. Most were, as we say, saved by deportation. And then others came out of hiding or were liberated from concentration camps. However, the story doesn't end there. First, there is a renewal of Jewish life in Poland on a small scale, and the post-war years gallery, which is the last of the historical galleries, tells a very, very important story, a story that is virtually unknown in the world, unknown among Jews, and little known among those living in Poland today. But in addition, there is the story of the approximately 9 million Jews in the world who descend from this territory, who made their lives in other places, who carried with them the legacy of Polish Jews, and who created a whole new world in the places where they settled. And that's a story that we would like to tell as an epilogue to the thousand-year story.
Well, Barbara, you led the development of the core exhibition of the museum. So was it a real challenge not to see Polish Jewish history through the lens of the Holocaust?
It was our mission that this story be told in the historical present, by which we mean that we ask our visitors to bracket what they know about what happened later. And so in the way in which we tell this thousand-year story, we tell it in the moment, and we don't look forward, and we don't anticipate the Holocaust, and we don't look back through the lens of the Holocaust. And this is critically important because the Holocaust is set within a thousand-year story of Polish Jews, not within a history of anti-Semitism, which is the usual story within which the Holocaust is set.
Well, then how do you make a chronological story that is 1,000 years long and could seem tedious to walk through, how do you make it seem present to the visitor?
Well, first, I would say our approach is what we would call chronothematic, meaning that, yes, there is a big chronological arc to the story, but the story unfolds thematically. And that means in any given period, thematically, it might be about the rise, for example, of rabbinical authority when the territory we think of as Poland becomes the center of the Ashkenazi world and becomes the home to the largest Jewish community in the world. And this happens certainly by the 16th century. What does religious life look like in the 18th century when there was a popularization of Jewish mysticism, of the Kabbalah? Or how did Jews confront the challenges of modernity in the 19th century? Or it might be, how did Jews confront the dilemma in the immediate post-war years of whether to stay or to leave? So I think it's the thematic development of the story that is our first step. But the second step is to create what I call a theater of history, in which the visitor is also an actor.
Well, it seems that one of the ways in which you do that is the visitor being brought into spaces where, I've read in one case, they're brought right inside an illuminated manuscript.
In the case of the Medieval Gallery, for example, the Medieval Gallery starts in 965 with a travel account by a Sephardic Jew from Cordoba who traveled across Europe and was the first, in terms of existing sources, to describe Poland. That medieval period goes all the way from 965 to about 1507. So it's almost 600 years, which is more than half of our millennium of the history of Polish Jews. For that period, the only two objects that relate directly to Polish Jews, meaning Jews in Polish territories, are coins that are the size of a penny, that have Hebrew writing on them, and tombstones. And for a 600-year story, coins and tombstones can't do the trick. And so what we did was we went to our sources, including rabbinical correspondence, travel accounts, chronicles, legal documents, and we found beautiful stories in them that really illuminated the history of Polish Jews and often quite personal and interesting stories. We took medieval illuminations from Hebrew manuscripts and also from Christian ones from the period. We took two comic book artists that have done some of the most marvelous, famous, beloved comics in Poland, and we asked them to illustrate the stories in a medieval style based on that material. And then we hired three conservators that specialize in the conservation of the painted interiors of Polish churches, and we asked them to paint these illustrations on the walls of the gallery. So the feeling when you come into it is that you are in an illuminated manuscript that is life-size, that is 360 degrees, and the gallery itself is completely hand-painted and hand-gilded with real gold. And what we've done is to put the story first. That is, we are a narrative exhibition. That means that the story is everything, and we use all tools to tell that story in a compelling, interesting, surprising, and engaging way.
Poland was once home to the largest Jewish community in the world. The Holocaust left a deep chasm in the history of Polish Jews. The Museum of the History of Polish Jews will honor those who died by remembering how they lived. It will celebrate the rich civilization created by Polish Jews in the course of a millennium and transmit it to future generations. This story extends to all the places in the world where Polish Jews live today.
My name is Rainer Mahlamaki, and I am the architect of this building, the Museum of the History of Polish Jews.
Is in performance to some extent, and of course, museum curatorship. Clearly, you've brought these two things together very much.
Yes, indeed. I have, since 1981, been teaching at New York University in the Department of Performance, studies, which is very broadly conceived, and I think of museums and their exhibitions as what I would call museum theater. If you will, still life theater. It's in a sense a theater without a proscenium. And the visitor is on the stage. The visitor is actually an actor in the story. We want our visitors to feel that they're inside the story and that they're hearing voices from the period. So the whole way in which we tell the story is in the first person through sources of the period, almost like a play script. So there are many, many ways in which this exhibition is a theater of history.
Well, when I think of voices from Poland, there are many that come to mind, but certainly the Baal Shem Tov, the founder, originator of Hasidism, comes to mind because we associate so many stories with him. How is he represented?
What we do is in the 18th century, the gallery dedicated to the 17th and 18th centuries, one of the centerpieces of that gallery is a beautiful reconstruction of a wooden synagogue. Its ceiling and roof that once stood in Gwoździec, which was in Poland, is today in Ukraine. And surrounding that synagogue are the stories of new religious leaders and new religious movements, spiritual movements, that start to emerge in the 18th century. And we actually start with the heretic, Jacob Frank, the Vilna Gaon, the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidism, and Mendel Leffen, who represents the Jewish Enlightenment. And we begin those stories with those figures, and then we pick those stories up in the 19th century when those movements become mass movements, and you can really see huge following and a kind of flowering of them.
Well, you mentioned that synagogue, which is truly extraordinary. I've seen photographs of it. It was, I think, destroyed in the First World War.
That's right.
How was it recreated? There must have been hundreds of artists involved.
Well, during the 17th and 18th centuries, there were hundreds of beautiful, beautiful wooden synagogues across the length and breadth of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. And they really represent the height of Jewish architectural creativity, but it is another wonderful example of what we would call a Polish-Jewish symbiosis. And of course, this territory included what is today Ukraine, Lithuania, Belarus, and Poland. During World War II, when the Germans invaded Poland, basically they destroyed all of these wooden synagogues. There's not one that was left standing. And I'm speaking now of the magnificent ones created in the 17th and 18th centuries. We partnered with Hans Haus Studio in Massachusetts, whose mission is to recover lost objects. And when they discovered wooden synagogues, they found their ultimate lost object. And what they say is, you can never recover the original object in the sense of the original material, but you can recover the knowledge of how to build it by building it using traditional tools, materials, and techniques. And that's what we did. We gathered together a team of around 300 volunteers, students, timber framers, specialist craftsmen, people who know all about the traditional historical painting, particularly in church interiors. And in a series of about 12 workshops, we actually, I say created rather than recreated, the painted ceiling and the beautiful timber-framed roof of this synagogue. And it is absolutely magnificent.
Yes, we'll have a photo of it on our website so that everyone listening to this interview can actually see it. Well, let's get down to brass tacks. I know the museum is mainly about Jewish life in Poland, which stretches across 1,000 years, but 6 years of that virtually annihilated it. So how does the museum represent the Holocaust?
First of all, there are 7 historical galleries from the medieval period to the post-war. The Holocaust is the single largest gallery. It's a double-height gallery on 2 levels. And we take, I think, a very unusual approach. First off, we set the Holocaust within 1,000-year history of Polish Jews. That's the first distinction I would make between our approach and what I think visitors are more familiar with. The second is that we look specifically at what happened within the borders of occupied Poland, a Poland that was occupied by 2 powers on September 1st, 1939, by the Germans, and 17 days later by the Soviets. And so the story unfolds within the borders of occupied Poland, and the story doesn't end with the Holocaust. It extends into the post-war period, and we want to extend it out into the rest of the world.
Well, your parents were from Poland and they managed to leave prior to the Holocaust. Did you ever imagine that you would be living in Warsaw for what, about
8 years?
8 years.
Well, my parents were born and raised in Poland, and my father was 17 when he left in 1934. He's from Opatów, or Upt in Yiddish, which is near Sandomierz, Ostrowiec, between Warsaw and Krakow. And we lost most of our family in the Holocaust because his parents, sisters, brothers, wives, husbands, children were murdered. And once I was asked by a journalist, well, how many of your family died in the Holocaust? It was never a question I'd ever asked because I never thought in numbers. But I asked my father and we started to count. When we got to 48, we stopped counting. It just didn't seem there was any point to count any further. And so they settled in Canada, in Toronto, and we went back to Poland. I went back to Poland for the first time in 1981, and my parents came with me in 1988. Again in 1995, and then repeatedly during the mid-2000s when I was already working on the museum and on the exhibition, and my parents knew about it and were very, very pleased. I don't think I'm surprised that I'm there. It gave me a feeling of completeness, of kind of closing a circle and of feeling closer to my family and to where they had come from and to the world that they had been part of and that they had helped to create. And it's a profoundly meaningful experience for me to be living in Poland today, which is, of course, not the Poland in which they grew up. But after we opened the exhibition, and I have to tell you that as of today, in the last maybe 2 years, with our soft opening, with an empty building, and our full opening exactly a year ago, we've had 1 million visitors. 1 million visitors. And in this period, the president of Poland gave several of us medals for our work on the museum. And as I stood in the presidential palace, and the president of Poland pinned a medal on my chest, and my father passed away about 5 years ago, I was thinking to myself, what would he think about this?
Sounds like he would have been pretty proud to see his daughter at the forefront of such change in Poland. Barbara Kirschenblatt-Gimblett, museum curator and now citizen of Poland. She says come visit her at the Poland Museum of Jewish History in Warsaw. That's the program. Look out for the film Pockets of Hope. And if you like the music, details will be on our website, where you can download the audio and see some pictures of my guests today. Look for us on the RN homepage. The program is produced by me and Jeff Wood, with sound engineering this week by Simon Branthwaite. And don't forget to follow me at Spirit of Things. Next time, it's Tantra, Four Ways. And guess what my guests don't want to talk about? Sex. Rest assured, I get it in there somehow. Let's talk about sex on The Spirit of Things next time with me, Rachel Kahn, on RN.